accession number 20937, Reel 11.
Neville Howell, Reel 11.
Yes, I remember on one morning, and it was a Sunday morning, if I remember rightly, from where we were, realised that the Germans were attacking the town with aircraft, and I was able to look up, straight up this road towards Nijmegen, and I could see where some of the bombs were going, and I thought to myself, they're very near what was now my girlfriend. So as soon as I got the opportunity, I made my way up to Nijmegen, although this was about a mile and a half or so from the town centre, to where my now girlfriend lived. And when I arrived there, I found my girlfriend splattered with blood on her dress, on her legs, arms. Apparently one of the bombs had landed in a part of a school ground attached to a big church, which was only about 50 yards or so from where my girlfriend lived. And she had gone there because she knew there were troops stationed in that schoolhouse. And she had helped look after some of the injured, including one young soldier, she told me, had his leg off, and she held his hand and comforted him while he was being attended by the medical personnel. And of course I arrived there soon after she got back home. And yes, that was the type of thing that went on all the time we were in that area. On another occasion, and here I hesitate because I know that this will give skeptics a field day. Nevertheless, for the purpose of record, I will go ahead with it. On one morning, I was on top of, standing on the rear of my tank destroyer, when I heard the noise of an aircraft engine coming from my left, coming from the direction of Nijmegen. I looked in that direction and I saw what I took to be immediately a German single-seater aircraft, fighter aircraft. He was flying very low, very slow, and he appeared to be looking down. He was on the other side of the road, following the line on the other side of the road, appeared to be looking down on the road. And being in the place where I was, standing on the back of my M10, my 50 caliber machine gun was handy, already loaded, with a box of bolt feed ammunition, 50 caliber. The various types, the ammunition itself was varied. There was high explosive, armour piercing, ordinary rounds, incendiary, and that type of thing, a mixture of ammunition. Describing the weather at the time, there was as if the ground had been covered with mist, a thick mist, which had now lifted, so there would be a thin cover of cloud, complete cover of cloud over the sky. It wasn't thick because it was bright. This aircraft was flying just below this stuff. And I opened fire on him. I knew exactly what to do because I'd seen too many people make mistakes in the past of firing at aircraft and all the shots going behind. You could see it by the tracer. I was determined not to do that. And I opened up what I took to be about a football pitch length in front of the aircraft. Immediately, we could see that my stuff was striking into the aircraft itself, into the engine part of the aircraft. I could see incendiaries flying off at different angles from the aircraft. and the aircraft continued as if nothing was happening to it. After what must have been just a few seconds, I deliberately made a brief hesitation and then continued with my swing to the right. And this brought all my stuff on the aircraft itself. And by the way, I wasn't aiming from the hip, from the shoulder or anything like that. I was firing from the hip, standing up above the gun, if you like, and firing from the from about hip height. And the cockpit of area of the aircraft now became a blur. Then the aircraft started to turn upwards in a climb. My stuff was still going into the aircraft, could see it quite plainly. And one other chap who was stood down on the ground yelled out, "You got him, Sarge, you got him, Sarge." But Sarge continued firing. As he was just about perpendicular, he entered the cloud, and you could still see my stuff going into him. You could still see it striking off at an angle from him as he even went into the cloud. And then I stopped firing, and after a second or so, the aircraft reappeared on its back at an angle of about 45 degrees, going back in the direction from which it had come. It went down behind the row of trees on the opposite side of the road. It was followed by a short, thin column of blue-grey smoke, and then nothing. And I looked and hoped that the pilot would come parachuting through the cloud, but he didn't. And obviously, the pilot had gone down with the aircraft. Landing, perhaps, my estimation, only a couple of hundred yards from where that poor Spitfire had put down on the first day we'd arrived in that area. And the one chap on the ground in the air, the only other chap from the battery, and there was nobody else had come out whilst the firing was going on. They'd all strayed off and gone their own separate ways, presumably. And he said, "Shall we go and have a look, Sarge?" I said, "No, the pilot didn't get out. Had the pilot got out, of course I would have done." And I set about immediately, together with this poor young chap who was one of the reinforcements, I haven't a clue what his name was, replacement, to take the barrel off the 50 caliber, change it, and clean the one that I'd used straight away. Yes, that was something, and I will come back to reason why it was never reported. I'll make comment on that later. Whilst we were still in that area, I had a bad touch of tonsillitis and flu, or whatever. I was became very ill. Bad tonsils, they were blown up. And I was carted off to one of the hospitals which had been set up in a school in the area. And from there, I was sent to a rear hospital in Eindhoven, which had been set up in a church or a school. And I got to hear that by other people that my battery had moved off, were no longer in that same area where I'd left them, where I'd been taken away from. And eventually I was discharged from the hospital to a camp, a holding camp for people like myself who were coming out of hospital or reinforcements coming out and that type of thing. And I got some haversack rations and left that camp so that I could get back to my own battery. Reason being that if I hung around in that holding camp, I was likely to be posted off to a strange regiment altogether. And after a while, your battery or your regiment becomes like home. You don't want to lose it. So I took off and I found my way back to my battery headquarters, which was down in the southern part of Holland, and battery headquarters was in a school. All the troops, if you like, the troops of the battery, were committed in battle with the Americans somewhere. And I settled down in that school thinking, I'm here and this is lovely. I've got a warm place in the school. But it wasn't long before I got the message to report up forward. And the driver, one of the battery drivers, took me up to where there was a very tough battle going on. The battle was mainly an attack being put in by Americans, who were supported here and there by British troops, including my troop. Oh, by the way, I was no longer rejoining my own troop, my old troop, H troop. I was now rejoining posted to I troop at the same battery. And naturally, they were people I had known, met before, but nevertheless, I now joined a strange crew, if you like, for the tank destroyer. And we were on a road, scattered along a road. The troop was scattered along this road together with American infantry. And the task of my troop was that on alternate days, two of us from the troop of four tank destroyers would take off in the darkness of early morning, go as quietly as possible along a road, and then swing off the main part of the road round to the right towards a small village where there was a small bridge crossing a small stream. One of the tank destroyers would take up a position near the small bridge, and the other would take up a position up a road which ran level with the small stream. My place was the position to go through was to the right, the extreme right of this little village alongside the small stream. We had to be very quiet, I knew this, and in fact, before we forked off to the right to go down to this little village, we had to pass an American checkpoint. Everybody passing that place had to stop and answer a challenge and be allowed to pass through. That was the drill. You had to do this all in total darkness, travelling as quietly as possible, which seems almost impossible with a 30-ton tank destroyer on tracks, but never mind. Yes, the first day I did this, we got in position in the darkness, excuse me, and as it got light, we started to make a brew up, and whatever we made, must have made some noise, because in no time at all we had mortar bombs coming down in our direction. We had to keep as quiet as possible throughout the day and keep as concealed as possible behind this one building. There was one building there, a house, like a bungalow with a big shed or something beside it. And waited there until it got dark in the evening before we were allowed to make our own way back to our own lines again. The little village was held by a small group of British infantry. I don't know who they were, never found out who they were, but didn't see them anyway because they kept themselves concealed all the time we were there. And that was what we had to do. This went on for quite some time. We spent with the Americans in that position where we took it in turns to go down in this little place for a day. And then the next day we would just stay where we were in the more or less a rear area. And on one occasion we went down We were determined to try to find out if what we took to be a little motorcycle and was any good. And yes, a couple of the boys went across and made sure it, by observation, that it wasn't booby-trapped in any way, and successfully got the thing to start up. And this brought down some mortar fire on us again, but we managed by the end of the day to get it on the back of our M10 and we took it back to the rear. I don't know what happened to it in the end, but I think in the rear position the boys had a bit of fun on it, riding it up and down. Eventually we left that position, and I believe the name of the town, and this is, by the way, what I should have said is that, yes, we were in the southern part of Holland here, near a place called Heerlen, and whilst we were, this was where the battery HQ had taken up its place, we, on a couple of occasions, I went back there, and we were able to have a bath in where the miners used to have a pit head. There used to be pit head baths or something there, and we were able to have a bathe there, and the other thing is, on one occasion, we were taken in this German town, where there are all American soldiers that were there, even some American armour. And
this is a Dutch town?
No. We crossed the where the Americans were in action, where I went to join them, was in Germany. Just up the, we had to go a few miles up the road, and you were in Germany, and that's where the action was taking place. And I believe the name of the German town nearest there was Geilenkirchen. And could be wrong there, but went into this German town after the Americans no longer needed us to keep taking up our position down in that place. And by the way, the Germans used to get patrols across that stream at night time and all that kind of thing, but never mind. We went into the term, and we had to share a cellar with American troops. And being what we were, we did our best to rig up lights and sit there playing cards. Well, what amused us was the fact that the Americans kept their steel helmets on all the time, even in the cellar. We never used to wear them at any time, but to have them on in the cellar seemed a bit over the top to us. But never mind, they were probably under orders to do that, but we found them very generous, which they were. The Americans were very, very generous to us. And eventually we were pulled back to battery headquarters, but which by now was occupying... I think there were some shops in a little town in Holland. No, we were pulled back across the Dutch, the German border in Holland, and in billets there. And whilst we were there, General Field Marshal Montgomery came to visit and inspect our battery because of the tough time they'd had, I suppose. And so each of the tank destroyer crews were stood in front of the tank destroyers, and Monty came along, shaking hands with some, and yes, that was it. A few days later that I remember, we got orders to get out on the road again and start up engines. We were going to push off, and this was late one afternoon. We didn't know where we were heading or anything like that. And it was just about dark when we took off from the whole battery took off from this position. We hadn't been told where we were going, hadn't been issued with maps, hadn't been given anything in the way of orders, which was unusual. And off we went on the road, heading north, back up, if you like, towards Eindhoven. And it was pitch dark, and of course there's no lights, and just obviously with it being dark you tend to hang back a bit, you don't want to ram into the people in front of you and all that type of thing. And in the darkness managed to make out the shape of what looked like a gun on the side of the road, and we stopped, and it was a gun. It was a 17 pound anti-tank gun with its limber full of ammunition, which had obviously become detached and we knew from the markings on it that it was one of our own regiment, one of our own regiment's ground guns. Two of the batteries were still ground guns. And so I hooked it up behind my M10, hooked it behind, and here we are now travelling with a 17-pounder up in the turret and towing a limber and 17-pounder gun behind. And kept on heading up that road in the darkness. Didn't see anybody at all. Kept going in that direction, which suited me fine. After all, I thought myself right back up to Nijmegen if possible. And carried on up the road right through the night. Came the dawn and we were near Eindhoven, where we were stopped by military police and directed into a schoolyard where there were a couple more soft vehicles from my regiment, as well as some other people, a couple of carriers and a mixture of vehicles, all stuff that had been stopped by the MPs and directed into that schoolyard. Of the battery, complete battery and that type of thing, no sign whatsoever. Anyway, whilst there, well, naturally we had to brew up and start to have a meal and all that type of thing, and soon got to hear that about the balloon going up in the Ardennes. And apparently, in fact, that's where we were should have been making for. But of course, we'd been led off in a northerly direction in the first place, so I'd kept going north, and that suited me fine, until we were stopped by the Red Caps. And anyway, had orders from the military police to get rations and fill up and take off to find catch up with the regiment somewhere. Direct south, going south now. So, because I was a sergeant and there were no other senior NCOs, I now had charge of a small convoy of mixed vehicles, some belonging to other units, now travelling on the road in the southerly direction, towing behind me a 17-pounder anti-tank gun. I wouldn't think it ever happened to anybody else in an M10 that they towed a 17-pounder behind them. Anyway, off we went down, making our way south. And on the way, yeah, I can remember we stopped at various places, and obviously there was a panic on. We got to hear what was going on, and some of the boys picked up information here and there to the effect that we could bump into Germans anywhere, that the Germans were swanning around all over the place. Needless to say, I think about a day later or so later, I fetched up with and found part of my regiment and handed over the ground anti-tank gun and eventually found my battery, caught up with my battery, and weren't with them very, not with battery HQ very long, got to my troop and the rest of my troop. Orders to take off, and again, no maps or anything like that. I don't think we had any maps of that particular area. Perhaps just one, the troop commander had one or whatever. But he led us off. It was tough going. The roads were icy, snow, extremely cold. And I can remember making our way along this one road. It was cobbled, but the icy as well. And it was so difficult for the drivers to keep heading in one direction. But somehow or other we managed it. Slowly we carried on. We saw Americans in different places and went passed on through them. We went out onto an open plain with the road running across it, and we carried on across this open plain. And we were obviously across the other side of this plain was a ridge, a wooded ridge. We made our way to this wooded ridge where for the first time we saw British troops, which we learned were in fact 6th Airborne Division, who had been brought out specially from England to plug a hole in what had been a collapsed American line. They were up on the top of the ridge. With great difficulty, we made our way up this ridge. It was rather difficult. There was a track leading up through a few old buildings, dilapidated looking buildings, which had obviously been occupied by civilians at some time or other. And up we got up to the top of the ridge where the troop commander, my now troop commander of I Troop, Lieutenant Wood, he told me to take up a position on some open ground with trees, wooded trees around like a square of open ground on the top. There was an old like farmhouse to the right of this position. The actual position for the M10 was in front of this, and the other M10s from the troops were scattered to my left somewhere. I don't know where their positions were exactly. I knew where Troop HQ, they'd picked out the best looking building of the small, I don't know what you would call it, just a few scattered houses, but the best building, Troop HQ took that, a little lower down the hill. And the job was to stay out in the open all day in position with the M10, pointing towards where the German lines. At night time, at dark, when it got dark, allowed to pull back to this old farmhouse type building for the night, but of course we all had to keep a guard on all night. And infantry were to my left. There was nothing to my right except trees. There was a path through these trees, a wide path going through the trees, and to my right rear was a lot of American equipment, including guns with ammunition. Told to strictly leave all the American equipment exactly where it was, not to touch it or interfere with it. And so that's how we passed the days. The weather was misty all the time, very foggy all the time. Snowing, I think it was just as the mist froze, there was light snow coming down all the while. There was quite a lot of snow. It was extremely cold. I wouldn't think it was above minus 20 at any time while I was up in that position. But the 6th Airborne, the ground was so frozen, they had managed to blow some holes. They dug other holes, but they were all to my left. Nothing to my right. No, none of our own troops to my right at all. I was the extreme right-hand position of that, up there with the 6th Airborne. And that's how we passed the time, going out all day in position, coming back at night to the old farmhouse. Now, in the farmhouse itself, it comprised two rooms. We went into the first room, and then the second room was a part wall, and then a gap covered by a kind of blanket. And then you passed into the rear room, which was bigger. Just a single-story building. In the bigger room, close to the part-dividing wall of the two rooms, was a huge stove. A huge stove. And near that was a long table and benches fitted, obviously handmade from the trees round about, whoever it was, probably a woodsman. Now, yes, this huge stove. Outside, along the side of the building, were stacked loads of logs ready for burning. So we were very fortunate in that I was able to keep this big stove, we were able to keep the big stove going all day and night for warmth. Lovely. And we rigged up a light from the M10 line going through into the building, so we had light. We all did this kind of thing. It was easy enough with spare batteries and that, so on. And bedding, there were two single type beds in the big room. There was one single type bed in the first room. I took the one single type bed. It wasn't cold in that first room either, because the flue from the big stove came through the part dividing wall and then ran up alongside it and up out through the roof, and that kept that building part of the building warm as well. I took the first single bed, so I was nearer the doorway leading out of the building, and the two beds inside were shared by the rest of the other four men of the crew. There was bedding, lovely, plenty of bedding, albeit very, very smelly. but nevertheless, warmth is warmth. And yes, it suited. And that's how we passed the days, out in position all during the day. We soon learned that we had to keep the turret free, because there was a tendency for it to freeze up so it wouldn't traverse. And we had to do all sorts of things to make sure that it would keep traversing. And the first time, I think we used boiling water. Water supply, as such, came from the snow. This is where we got our water from the snow. Plenty of it about. And rations were not in great...